Nope. It tweeted the regular way. All right. Welcome in to the Ari Marov NFL show. This is the first time we've ever done this live on my Twitter and on YouTube. And joining me here today, he is a colleague here at PFF and a salary cap expert. It is Brad Spielberger. Brad, welcome back to the show. There's a football game on tonight. It's like finally here.
We finally made it. The Hall of Fame game in Canton definitely still counts. I don't care about any arguments to the contrary. Definitely still counts as football.
It counts. Jaguars, Raiders, preseason football, nothing like that. But well, usually when football is back, that would be the top story in the NFL. But not this year. There's a lot of stuff going on in the NFL that has, I don't know if it's like the potential, I think it is already overshadowing all these games that are coming up. So let me start with Deshaun Watson. And we'll go back to Monday. Judge Sue L. Robinson on Monday, she gives a 6-game suspension. She puts out a 15-page ruling with all her findings. And she essentially agreed with the NFL that he, under the personal conduct policy, he violated it. She said Watson violated it in 3 different ways. The reason she got to 6 games in part was based off prior precedent, whether it's with Ben Roethlisberger, Ezekiel Elliott, but the NFL believes there's no prior precedent to compare with this, especially when you see in her ruling, we have egregious behavior, predatory behavior. So 6 games for the NFL was nowhere near enough for them, and the NFL exercised their right yesterday to appeal this, and will now look to hand down what they always wanted, which was a full year suspension with potential fines and mandatory treatment as well. Let me ask you this. Where do you see this going? Because there are some options here, right? The NFL could just, you know, lay down the hammer, which will lead to the union suing, and it could just get really ugly from there. Maybe they could talk about a settlement and make sure this doesn't drag out as long as it could possibly, whenever, if it does go to court and they lay down the hammer. What do you think actually happens here?
You know, I do think we'll get the response from the NFLPA in the next 48 hours. And then obviously someone will just review those documents. There's no more arguments or anything of that nature. You know, it's interesting because Goodell has now chosen to, you know, appoint someone that is outside of the NFL league office to be this appellate judge, if you want to call the person that. And I struggle to see how that person can, you know, unilaterally arrive at a much more significant suspension without there being some type of directive from the NFL. So, you know, I do think they're going to, you know, maybe add games. I think a fine is also a very significant component of it. Obviously, suspension is supposed to penalize the player not only for missing games, but also losing game checks. And because Watson had a minimum salary, the penalty was $345,000, which to him is basically nothing. That, I think, could be where the middle ground comes, is the games maybe stay the same, or maybe it goes to 8, but not a significant addition. But you do then levy, you know, a $10 million fine or something like that. He would have lost about $11.6 million under his old contract with the same 6-game suspension. So maybe you bridge the financial gap there, but keep the games kind of where they are.
You know, I'm just looking at this, and if the NFL does go the route where it's a full year with the fine, with the treatment and all of that, the union will strike back and they'll take this to court. And there's potential for this just to be a topic for kickoff week, week 1, week 2, week 3. It's going to overshadow the entire season. As soon as the league announced yesterday that they were appealing this, there were reports from several different outlets that the league is looking for the full year, the hefty fine, and the treatment, right? Do you think the NFL put that out because they want to send a message to the union to get back to settlement talks, or else we're fine dragging this out? Because the reality is the NFL has always prevailed in court. If you look back at Brady, you look back at Zeke, they ultimately end up winning the whole thing, but it just takes some more time for it to get to that result. Do you think they put the reports out yesterday that we're going all the way in on this just so maybe we can get back to settlement talks and find some common ground here?
I do think that's entirely possible. One thing we've talked about before is that Roger Goodell in past cases was very adamant about, he cared just as much about the player seeking therapy or talking with a counselor or just generally expressing remorse and showing that they knew they'd committed wrongdoing. Ben Roethlisberger received a 6-game suspension, but it was reduced to 4 because he did all those things I just listed out. And I think one thread they'll maybe try to pull from Judge Robinson's decision is, even though she says she can't kind of go outside the confines of past decisions, she still added on that he must receive all massage therapy from Cleveland Browns trainers. There's obviously zero precedent for that. And it also is kind of an admission of clearly there's something here. And clearly I think he could present a threat in the future because his stance the entire time has been, I did nothing wrong. I don't think I have any reason to be remorse. I don't want to go see a mental health professional because I don't think I need or have a problem and all those things. And I think that also kind of maybe bothers the NFL just as much as the financial stuff and all these things. And so, you know, long answer short, I do. I think maybe that is their way of saying, okay, we're going to present to the media a bunch of different outlets that we're going to go full steam. If you come back and say, all right, we'll meet somewhere in the middle. And we'll also have him admit that he clearly, whether he understood what he was doing at the time or not, certain bodies, including, you know, Sue Robinson, found there was enough evidence and enough reason to believe he did something wrong. We need him to express that he feels he did something wrong, which he has not done so far.
Right. I feel like part of this also, and why the NFL is probably so upset, is that Deshaun Watson essentially lied. Like, Judge Robinson's findings show there was egregious and predatory behavior, and he has been, he hasn't been remorseful at all throughout all this, even though the Browns put out a statement the other day saying that he has. We actually have a video here. The last time he spoke was a few weeks ago, and this is what he had to say when he spoke to local reporters.
At the same time, you know, I've been honest and I've been truthful about my stance, and that's, you know, I never forced anyone, I never assaulted anyone. So that's what, you know, I've been saying it from the beginning, and I'm going to continue to do that. And until all the facts come out on the legal side, I have to continue to just, you know, go with the process of my legal team and you know, the court of law.
Right. So that's what he said the last time they spoke publicly. And Judge Robinson's 15-page ruling basically said the entire opposite of that. And the real reason why it's six games, like we mentioned before, was because of prior precedent, or in part, that's why it was a six-game suspension. The NFL is now looking to go higher than that. And also, I believe, and we spoke about this last night on PFF at night, the NFL has a chance over here to set a new precedent when it comes to violating the personal conduct policy, right? When it comes to violence towards women, when you look at how the league has ruled on other stuff, whether it was a full year suspension for gambling for Calvin Ridley, six games for PEDs recently for DeAndre Hopkins, the NFL's policies over the years treated those stuff more seriously than what Deshaun Watson did and what other people have done in past when it comes to the personal conduct policy. It makes no sense that the system up until now has functioned in a way where personal conduct violations are not getting severe punishments. This is their chance to reset that and to send a message and to finally get it right. And I also believe, like, for Roger Goodell's legacy, the way he'll be remembered as commissioner of the NFL, this could definitely go a long way for him towards that. Going back to that video we just played of Deshaun Watson, do you just feel like Watson not being honest to investigators and not showing any remorse up until now is something that the NFL is thinking about and is a reason why they might push to go extra hard on him?
I would even go so far as to say this, is that it may not even be about a lack of honesty. There may be a concern that he genuinely does not understand the predatory and violent, at least for a threat of violence, if not actual violence, kind of the nature of what he did. You know, yeah, he could also just be lying and know very well what he did, but you could argue maybe it's even worse in some respects for him to genuinely believe that he did nothing wrong, because therefore why would he not want to, you know, continue doing similar things down the road, which of course, again, is why Sue Robinson literally has it in her finding that he must use only in-house therapists, clearly suggests that she thinks it's possible as well. So I think either way you look at it, I do think that plays into kind of part of the appeal process is we also just want to prevent future instances from occurring, because that, again, is maybe the worst outcome, worst case scenario, where your punishment was so not severe that he, you know, it didn't curtail and curb his behavior, which is what you're supposed to be trying to accomplish with this entire process.
Yep. And I think, you know, in that report where she mentioned that he could only have massages through the club, that is basically her saying, we don't trust you. I mean, that's basically the way I look at it whenever she put that in to the report. One more thing on this, as we saw with Ezekiel Elliott and Tom Brady, when they pushed their situations to court, they were allowed to play after getting a temporary restraining order. It remains unclear if Watson will be able to do that. Have you heard anything about if there's a scenario where this does get to court, where Watson could be playing come week one? Because I've seen both sides of that. I've seen some people say yes, some people say no, because of this new system that is currently in place with the NFL.
So I lean towards it not happening, not necessarily because of the personal conduct policy system, but because of a point that, you know, Pro Football Talk, Mike Florio has raised, but a couple other attorneys as well, is that he didn't appeal and obviously publicly said he was not going to appeal the initial six-game suspension. So to then ask for a temporary restraining order and try to kind of pause the current punishment and play right away, you kind of throw that out the window by not appealing the original six-game suspension in the first place. If you were to appeal the second, you know, finding, it would be more of a, hey, we're not happy with the procedure that took place here, and we're not happy with six turning into, you know, a full season plus a fine, but we're not actually, you know, attacking and fighting this original six game suspension. And the second thing too is it probably doesn't work in his favor. You know, another component of this is because of the way his contract was structured, he has a $46 million salary next year in 2023, only $1 million, you know, $35,000 in 2022. So if he's going to serve a suspension and he made it clear he was fine serving a six-game suspension, he wants to get that done as soon as possible.
And I think it's worth noting that if the NFL and NFLPA do go back to having some settlement talks here in these next couple of days, that before the six-game suspension was announced, the NFL offered a 12-game suspension and a $10 million fine, which is how much he made last year while not playing with the Texans. And the NFLPA essentially declined that, and essentially Judge Robinson's ruling came down, and now the NFLPA is appealing that. So that was their last offer before Monday's ruling came in. I do believe, and I think it's been reported now, that the NFL gave 12 games because in their week 13 game, which is 12 weeks, is they're playing the Houston Texans in Houston. For some reason, the NFL does not want Deshaun Watson on the field for that game in particular. So they're adamant of at least 12 games. Obviously, they're arguing for a full year. But I believe in settlement talks, they're going to be asking for at the very least 12 games. We'll see if they're able to get something done, or if essentially Roger Goodell or his designee, it sounds like a designee, will hear the appeal and they will make a ruling here coming in the near future. One more thing here on this as well, just going back to football only. We've talked about this a lot, but if it was six games, Jacoby Brissett fills in, it makes a lot of sense. This thing is not staying six games. Should the Browns look to add a quarterback now, potentially a Jimmy Garoppolo, whether it's a trade or if he gets released in the coming weeks, because I don't know how they view Jacoby Brissett if it's a full year of him playing.
You know, I think it's worth considering, right? We talked a lot about this. Depending on the length, would they really need to go out and do so? Their first 4 weeks of games is really, really easy. And then in week five and six, it's the Chargers and the Patriots. Maybe that's out of order. And then the Ravens in week seven. So it really ramps up and you get some more tough division games. The Garoppolo situation at this point, I think if you were to make a trade, the 49ers would probably, you know, really agree to anything. You could probably throw a day three pick and you would say, look, Garoppolo then also has to agree to chop his salary down significantly from $24 million to maybe, you know, $6, $7 million, in which case, you know, maybe you could go about it that way. Another thing to note as well, if Watson gets a full season suspension, his contract tolls. And what that means is instead of covering 2022 to 2026, it would actually cover 2023 to 2027. So it kind of changes the entire dynamic of his financial situation from a salary standpoint. So I do think at that point, maybe a guy like Cam Newton I floated out, but you look at potentially other options. But Brissett is one of the best backup quarterbacks in the NFL, though. So they're in decent hands, at least for now.
Right. And again, just this Browns roster is just so stacked that they're ready to win right now. It just makes you wonder if they're okay with Brissett for a full year compared to having him for six games. I believe he started five games last year from Miami. It was pretty decent in those games. He's been in these situations twice before, which is crazy to think about. He was thrown into it when Tom Brady was suspended. Garoppolo got hurt. So he became the quarterback for, I believe, a game and a half or two games. Then Andrew Luck retired all of a sudden. He became the starter there. And now he's here in the scenario of Deshaun Watson, where he's suspended as of now for six games and will most likely be more than that. And he will be thrust into action. It's also bizarre to think about, but Deshaun Watson could very well tie into this whole Dolphins tampering story, because the Dolphins traded for Watson last year before the trade deadline. Brian Flores is probably still the coach. all this tanking and tampering stuff that came out this week probably never comes out. And this Watson situation is likely all unfolding in Miami right now, and that would be the main story in Dolphins land, not Tom Brady and Sean Payton. Let's talk a little bit about this whole Tom Brady, Sean Payton, and tampering stuff with Stephen Ross and Bruce Beal. Let me start with this, because when the NFL put out the statement, it came out with the tanking stuff and the tampering stuff. The tampering stuff is what they got hit hard with. The tanking stuff, not really. Do you feel like the NFL couldn't come down hard on Stephen Ross for tanking because of all the implication that it would have? Like, there are so many implications that if he is found guilty on that, whether it's the gambling element of it or just the integrity of the game, so they decided to come down hard on him for tampering and kind of stuff the tanking stuff to the side a little bit.
Yeah, the integrity, and I think we're going to touch on the word integrity again a little bit, kind of tying these two cases together. But the integrity of the game matters a ton to the NFL, and I think you nailed it on the head there too. Also, when you're trying to roll out sports gambling being accepted now in, I think, 28 states in the country, there are teams trying to add brick and mortar sports books either in their stadiums or, you know, right across the street. Obviously, you know, these mobile options, the NFL is now partnering with different books and various different, you know, ventures. So yes, it is extremely important, and to have any implication that a team would be willing, you know, to tank and intentionally lose football games, it kills you from a, you know, viewership perspective, from a trust in the league product. But then also, finally, yeah, I mean, how can you then at the same time be negotiating these massive gambling opportunities when you don't even know for a fact if all 32 teams are truly trying to win every Sunday? I do. I think this punishment was kind of for both, but they had to, you know, kind of pretend that there was no actual implication of tanking in Miami.
Because, you know, it's crazy, but it literally says they found on numerous occasions that the owner of the team, Stephen Ross, said he believed it was better to improve draft position in 2020 than to win games in 2019. And essentially, the NFL believed that he was saying it in a joking manner. Essentially, Brian Flores saved them in all of this by not taking that seriously and actually trying to win every single game there in 2019, which they did win a couple of games on the back end of 2019. And then they ended up having the fifth overall pick, and they drafted Tua with that pick. Let me ask you this, because, you know, I'm looking around social media. Dolphins fans are very upset with this ownership group, because on one hand, we don't have a first and third round pick now because of two people we don't even have. On the other hand, I'm looking at this and I'm like, they were trying to get Joe Burrow and Tom Brady. You know what I mean? Like, they really were going all out. Should they be that upset with them, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, they weren't successful in any of those things. So I think it's still fair to be upset. We kind of joked last night on PFF at night. The NBA does this all the time. But, you know, Jalen Brunson still went to the Knicks. And I think it was, I forget, someone with the Bulls last year, maybe DeMar DeRozan, whoever it was. Like, when those, yeah, you know, enterprises are tampering, they tend to get the job done. So I do think it's fair, though, to also say, well, look, I mean, your owner is willing to do whatever it takes. The Patriots and Tom Brady, infamously, you know, if you ain't cheating, you ain't trying, and all those things. So I think you got to give him a little bit of credit just for be willing to do whatever it takes. But I think you got to actually, you know, be successful in one of those, you know, attempts.
You know, there's one thing that I'm wondering right now, because Sean Payton stepping down as Saints head coach, it kind of came out of nowhere. I'm wondering now that if he knew that this thing would all blow up, is he still the Saints head coach right now?
It's a fair question. I mean, if they caught wind that he was having conversations with another club during the season, it potentially, you know, maybe they fire him, or maybe just things end differently. I do think to a degree he was somewhat bulletproof in New Orleans. I mean, I think he really means so much to that organization, and has obviously been, you know, the fact that he, you know, won 8 games last year with 4 quarterbacks and all those things, like, you don't really fire a guy like that. And you probably, you know, maybe something we should say is, maybe these type of conversations are happening more often than we frankly realize. They just don't come to light in the public eye. But it is a good question. He left on his own terms. He's now kind of a footnote in the story. And when he does come back, I mean, unless he goes to Miami, that'll probably, you know, rekindle the flame. But if he goes to Dallas, like I think we all kind of expect at this point, sorry, Mike McCarthy, then, you know, it kind of will just be brushed under the rug.
You know, because the reality is, like, Sean retired or stepped away. Tom Brady also retired / stepped away. Tom was able to go back to Tampa. Sean couldn't just walk back in and say, oh, I want my job back now. So he's away from football for this season because it didn't work out in Miami. The other thing I'm wondering about as well is, you're right. There are talks all the time going on in the NFL with other people, with players. I mean, tampering happens. It's just the reality. The one thing I wonder now is that Sean Payton is not a coach this season, but people are going to be going after him. But is it going to be a scenario now where he won't be as aggressive doing it because he just got caught? Do you think this will at least slow things down for Sean Payton this year? Because back in July last month, we were talking about Sean Payton. Do you think things are going to quiet down a little bit now because this Dolphin stuff came out?
Yeah, potentially. But I think, you know, once games start happening and that action is underway, I think, you know, these offseason storylines are obviously exciting and a lot of banter when they drop. But as soon as games start getting played and especially, you know, getting to playoffs and stuff like that, I think, yeah, he'll be quiet. It'll be more under the radar. But I guess I should say that, you know, the one point I think this stuff probably happens a lot more frequently, maybe not with coaches as much. But look, there's a reason why. March 17th at 4:01 p.m. Eastern, there's already 25 eight-figure contracts agreed to. I think that's probably for a reason.
I mean, like, just sticking to that tampering element, like, how could the NFL decide when they want to enforce the tampering rules? Like, I remember they did it once for Jeremy Maclin when he went from the Eagles to the Chiefs and reunited with Andy Reid. Andy Reid apparently spoke to him during before free agency, and that's how they got him. But as you said, like, the stuff happens year round, but after the season is over, these teams are talking to agents. Like, I think you can make a good argument that Tampa Bay, when they got Tom Brady, it's not like they just started talking to him when free agency started. Like, they had talks with him before. It's the reality of the league. How do you think the NFL just determines this stuff with tampering? Like, it's like so all of a sudden.
It's a great question. I do think that in the report a little bit, they talk about just the level, the amount that happened, how kind of open and flaunted they did with it, you know, how it involved, you know, ownership, like you mentioned Bruce Beal last night, a minority owner in Miami. So, you know, so many people involved, so many conversations. I think also they highlighted that it started in December of 2019. So the Patriots are in the middle of a playoff push, you know, in your own AFC East division. So, all those things. I think it was more about just the egregiousness of the acts. Yeah, I think it's different when it's, you know, it's February, you're not in the playoffs, the Super Bowl's over. Technically, the league year is a month off. You know, that's a little bit different than, you know, December of the year when Brady's trying to, you know, make the playoffs and get the one seed that year, which they just barely missed out on. I think that's a little bit different.
I remember, if I'm not mistaken, I'm pretty sure I'm right. February 2020, the combine, 1 month before COVID, Bruce Arians had his media availability. He literally said Tom Brady's name at his press conference about quarterbacks we'll go after, which essentially that is tampering, right? So I just don't know exactly how the NFL operates, what is tampering, what is not. You are right. They did consider this one to be very egregious. I believe they said it was the most egregious they've ever seen. That's what Roger Goodell said when his ruling came out on this earlier this week. One more thing on this as well, when it comes to just the Dolphins as a team, they actually have joint practices coming up here next week with the Buccaneers. I think that will be very interesting. But does this story, do you think, become a bit of a distraction for them? Because this is now like official, like Mike McDaniel, Tua, like, we like you guys, but you guys were really our plan B this offseason. And now it's like out there. You guys really were our plan B. Everyone knows this now. Do you feel like that potentially becomes a thing in Miami? It becomes a bit of a distraction there?
You know, I would say this. I think they're already, even without this story, I mean, Mike McDaniel was the last head coach hired in the entire cycle. I think, you know, for a reason, frankly, not any shade to Mike McDaniel, but, you know, they obviously took their time. It was a very long process. And Tua has been feeling that way probably since the day he got drafted. So I would actually say this. It almost might motivate them to kind of prove everyone wrong and just say, look, we're not who they wanted. Let's show them that they're wrong and we should have been their option A. I would almost go that direction and say it's kind of a motivation, you know, in a perverse way to get them to really try to prove everyone wrong and win some football games this year.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy to think about, but since Tua got there in 2020, he was drafted in the COVID year. Before that draft, there were all the talks about the Dolphins trying to trade up to number one for Joe Burrow. They ended up getting Tua at five. They couldn't trade up. The next year, he obviously had the Ryan Fitzpatrick stuff in and out. The next year, there's the Deshaun Watson stuff. Now there's the Tom Brady stuff. He's never had his full share of just, this is my team. He did say yesterday that he feels like the team is all in with him. And if you look at the moves they made this offseason, it does feel like they are all in. But you can make a serious argument. There is no quarterback in the NFL that has more pressure this upcoming season than Tua in Miami. One last thing on this. on this Miami stuff. Do you believe that if Mike and Tua don't succeed this year, Sean and Tom are available come next year? Do they circle back to that?
If there aren't, you know, they're afraid of further, you know, complications or issues, I think it is entirely possible. I will say again, losing next year's first round pick, they still do have the 49ers, but that I think was, you know, kept the Tyreek Hill trade and all these things. They made sure they had two first round picks. That was the other avenue to potentially trade up and draft a replacement for Tua Tagovailoa. With that out the window now, if they don't believe what they see in him, yeah, maybe they do circle back to, you know, a couple future Hall of Famers and just say narratives be damned. We want to win some football games and make the playoffs for the first time in a while, and we'll do whatever it takes.
Because here's the thing, Tom, you don't have to trade for him. You would have had to trade for him this past offseason. Tom next year is a free agent no matter what. They can franchise tag him as part of his contract. Sean, you would have to trade for. They do have at least one first-round pick to be able to do that. So that element is still alive, I guess. Obviously, there's a lot of football to be played, but I think we definitely have to just keep an eye on that. I think it will be a storyline throughout the season if Miami does have some struggles this year. Let's quickly answer some questions here in the comments. We actually had a wide receiver contract extension get done here earlier today with Diontae Johnson in Pittsburgh. Sean is asking for your thoughts on that deal. A two-year contract extension, so a short-term deal for him, but it comes down at about $18 million per year. What'd you think about that?
Yeah, so at the outset, when you do shorter term deals, you're obviously not going to get as much money or much money per year. But when you see the other 2019 draft class players get these 3-year extensions, and Terry McLaurin, DK Metcalf and Deebo Samuel, and they're still reaching that $23-24 million per year range, for Johnson to get below $20 million per year, and also a very important note for folks that don't know this, a ton of times when you're negotiating an extension with a very good player, you basically say, what is the franchise tag for next season at this position? And then the rule for franchise tags is a second tag is 120% of that number. And then you kind of start there and work off of it. So we have a wide receiver franchise tag projected around $20 million next year. Diontae Johnson was by far the best pending free agent wide receiver. And then it means his second tag would be $24 million roughly. So $44 million over 2 years. He gets about $36 million instead. It is a really, really, really good deal for Pittsburgh. Yes, Johnson can get back to the market really quickly, but this is a slam dunk win, in my opinion, for the Steelers.
I mean, like, the sense throughout was that the Steelers were never going to go towards the top end wide receiver money. So going short term with a lesser AAV makes sense for them. I just don't really fully understand the deal for the player. I mean, I get it. He was a third round pick, so he's barely made that much money on the field so far in his career. So this gets you the security. But again, he's also playing this year with a rookie quarterback and Mitch Trubisky. So you don't know if his numbers will still be the same come next year. But you look at the wide receiver free agent market next year, who's out there? There's like Alan Lazard. There is Nelson Aguilar. There aren't any high-end names there. So if he was able to get to the open market, he would have by far been the top guy available. I guess let me just ask you this when it comes to that contract. Was that a deal worth signing for him? Like, should he have at least considered going, at least he has to reach $20 million, right? He has to get to that franchise tag number, like you said.
And that's my opinion. Yeah. And I would say the biggest benefactor, I think, is DJ Chark. You're looking at those free agents. He's, you know, young and you know, got the 1 year deal in Detroit. But yeah, no, I agree. You have to at least try to get in the conversation or, you know, have a cash flow in the first year that gets you that same amount. He does get $19 million in the first year, so he's close. But no, that is what it comes down to. Is I'm not saying he had to get $23-24 million, but even a, you know, 2 year $40 million extension, I know it's not a huge gap. But I would say this, you mentioned kind of he hasn't made a lot of money. I also do think, I'm not trying to be silly or anything like that, but I think the Steelers definitely made a solid argument. Look, your volume was heavily predicated on the fact that Big Ben had the lowest average time to throw the football in the NFL the last couple of years. You got 169 targets last year, yet still trailed all the guys we talked about in actual yards, because your yards per reception was about 10 yards per reception, which, again, it's not his fault. He does make guys miss an open space. He is a talented player, but I think they really convinced him. Not only those things kind of inflated his numbers, but then that B, this year's offense is going to be much more predicated on running the football. Mitchell Trubisky or Kenny Pickett or Mason Rudolph or whoever it is not going to be able to feed you to the same extent. We're also have new mouths to feed with Calvin Austin and George Pickens, yada, 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 yada. I think they convinced him on all those narratives, which maybe were true to an extent, but end of the day, this is a great deal for Pittsburgh any way you look at it.
Yep. So he'll be back on the field. He was actually holding in up until now. Be back on the field with Claypool. You mentioned George Pickens, who has been, sounds like he's been a superstar there at training camp. And Calvin Austin, Pat Freiermuth, Najee Harris, a lot of young talent there in Pittsburgh. And Deontay is the sixth receiver taken from that stacked 2019 wide receiver class to get extended this offseason, joining A.J. Brown, DK Metcalf, Deebo Samuel, Terry McLaurin, and Hunter Renfro. Last question here coming in from the comment section. What should the Lions do at quarterback? This comes from a guy named Not an Expert. What should the Lions do at quarterback? Obviously, it's Jared Goff right now. But come next year, should they trade for a veteran or trade up for a rookie, assuming they pick 10 to 20. It's also, we should mention that the Lions actually have two first round picks next year, thanks to the Matthew Stafford trade.
Yeah, you know, I think the veteran option has become more realistic over the last couple of years. Obviously, this offseason with guys like Russell Wilson on the move, if someone does come available, you obviously should explore those avenues. If you think maybe a player is in his younger 30s, aligns with the timeline of when, you know, Aiden Hutchinson and all these young players are going to start playing good football. But I also, if you don't feel that way, you probably should, you know, be willing to go the rookie route if you like some of these, you know, prospects in the draft. It sounds like it's going to be a great draft class, of course, with Bryce Young, C.J. Stroud, Will Levis, a lot of names in this class. But they have great opportunities ahead of them. I think the Lions are doing a rebuild exactly how they should. And yes, Goff, from a financial standpoint, after this season is when you can move on pretty cleanly.
Yeah, but I've mentioned this a bunch here, whether it was on this show or on PFF and I or wherever. I've really enjoyed seeing how the Lions, led by Brad Holmes, have done this rebuild. I think they've added a bunch of building blocks onto this roster. They have a rock solid offensive line. They're building up that defense. They have a pretty nice receiving group now of Jamison Williams and Amon-Ra St. Brown. DJ Chark is there for this year at the very least. Just building up that roster, and eventually they'll be able to drop in a quarterback to this roster. He'll join a roster that is basically stacked. You're not building with him, but rather the roster is already in a good shape, and the quarterback will have a chance to have immediate success. And eventually also Brad Holmes and the rest of that regime will start spending some real money in for agency to bring in some talent as well. So I've enjoyed seeing how they've done things there in Detroit. It's only a matter of time until they figure out and get their long-term quarterback. All right, that will do it here for this week's Ari Mayer of NFL Show. Brad, I'd like to thank you for coming on once again. Everyone can follow you on Twitter. It is at @PFF_Brad. And I'll be back once again next week with more news and notes from around the NFL. And I think we'll probably do it once again streaming live on Twitter and YouTube.